the ProPublica podcast. I'm Mike Webb, and today we're going to take a look at the people who help our military function in war zones like Iraq and Afghanistan. These people deliver fuel, guard diplomats, and serve as translators for our soldiers. As of last year, more than 1,700 had died and nearly 40,000 had been injured. Yet they're treated very differently than members of our military when they're injured overseas. Instead of getting the support and medical care they often need, injured military contractors have to fight insurance companies like AIG and federal government bureaucracy to get the benefits they're entitled to. T. Christian Miller's been writing about their plight for ProPublica, and last month he won the Selden Ring Award for investigative reporting for his coverage. T., can you explain what happens to the contractors after they've been injured?
Sure. After an injury to a contractor, they're usually evacuated from the country just like any one of the members of the military are. What happens when you get back to this country, though, is very different. For somebody who's in the Army, they can expect to go into the DOD, Department of Defense, healthcare system, that's including the VA and military facilities. But if you're a civilian contractor, you're kind of on your own to confront the insurance companies to try and convince them to pay for your care.
Are they left all alone to get proper health care?
Yes. They have theoretically the ability to go and get their own doctor, to get treatment at their own hospital. But it becomes like any other insurance battle, which is that you have to get the care approved first by the insurance company before any operation can take place or any kind of visit can take place. And that's where you see the battle begin. The request is made to the insurance company, like AIG, which is the dominant player in this particular type of insurance. And then AIG can say, sorry, we don't think that your claim is going to be paid. It's not covered by our insurance. And this begins the kind of battle that a lot of Americans are familiar with their insurance companies.
And is it the federal government or private insurance companies that are supposed to provide the benefits for them?
Right. And this is why it's I think the difference comes in is that if you're having a regular health care insurance battle, you've been paying your premiums, or your employer has been paying your premiums. In this case, the American taxpayer actually pays for the care for these injured individuals as part of something called the Defense Base Act, which is a law which says that if you're going to send somebody overseas as a defense contractor, the American government has to protect you in case you're injured. And so taxpayers end up funding and paying for this system, but AIG ends up keeping any of the money that they don't have to pay out for these injured contractors.
Okay. And do the contractors know about this before they go over there? Do they know about the insurance program?
They're supposed to. And what you find is that one of the interesting things about the contractors that's little known is that two-thirds of the contractors are actually foreigners. There are Iraqis, there are Afghans. There are people from places like the Philippines, Canada, Europe, other countries, and only about a third of the Americans. So this system was designed for an American system of government and for American contractors. And so those individuals often know something about this, the concept at least, that you're going to be covered by insurance and the idea of workers' compensation insurance. If you're from the Philippines, you won't have any sense of that at all. There's a nationalized healthcare system. You go to the doctor, you see the doctor. There's no sense of the insurance industry and fighting, disputing claims and what's covered and what's not covered.
So how did you track down some of the people you wrote about in your pieces?
It was a really difficult story because you've got three kind of big privacy walls here. You have medical privacy, you have corporate privacy, and then you have the sort of war zone chaos that just keeps you from being able to understand what's going on, because there is always a certain amount of battlefield fog where you don't know exactly what's happened. So it was really a process of gaining a few yards at a time, where you'd find one contractor who may know somebody else. You'd find one attorney who was representing two or three of these guys for court. I had people actually in the insurance industry who would help point me to some of the more egregious cases. It was especially difficult in terms of tracking down those civilian contractors who were from foreign countries, places like the Philippines, and just having to kind of go into neighborhoods and knowing that KBR had been recruiting there and asking around until we found somebody who could say, oh, yes, this is the guy who got injured here. We went to Nepal. I went to the Philippines. A colleague went to South Africa. Another colleague went to Peru. We went to Jordan. Just trying to track down individuals as we got got names.
Right. And I would imagine that the families were glad to hear from you because they're probably eager to share their stories.
No, not always, actually, because there's quite a stigma, at least in some quarters, with being a contractor. Contractors seen as war profiteers or mercenaries. And there's certainly any number of civilian contractors who have engaged in all sorts of bad behavior. There's some we're certainly willing and happy to talk, and we're quite proud of their service. And there's a number of civilian contractors who will tell you we went abroad because it was to help out the country, but also to make money. So it is a secretive world, especially amongst the private military contractors. It's sort of those guys often come from a world of secrecy and black operations, and so that stays in effect today.
Right, right. Well, what's the mental state of many of the people you spoke to?
Oh, so I'm not a psychologist or a psychiatrist, but there was a number of guys who had numerous diagnoses from doctors saying they were suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. I think just from a common perspective, some of the people I talked to, you could definitely tell had trouble remembering things, seemed sort of spacey or out of it, symptoms you associate with traumatic brain injuries as well as with PTSD. There, of course, were the more severely injured people who were missing limbs and arms or waiting for surgeries for those things. So it depended on the person. There was a lot of frustration, especially when there was a prolonged battle. It's almost make it worse, really. Their sense of having been abandoned and being angry by that.
T, last week our producer spoke to a contractor who's in a situation similar to the people you spoke to in your latest story. His name is Bill Carlisle, and he worked as a contractor in Iraq for the defense company KBR. He had to wear a bulletproof vest because he worked in the open, transporting materials on a truck. Bill had already had surgery on a hernia, but went back to work a few months later. Let's listen.
Every time I bounced up and down, the 60-pound bulletproof vest would jab into the surgical site, and it just kept getting worse and worse and worse until they sent me home the last time, and I had surgery again on the left side when they found I had another injury. So now I've become totally disabled and diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder.
Bill's case is not an unusual case by any stretch of the imagination. You've had any number of individuals who have been diagnosed with just average everyday work injury. You have a hernia, lifting something, putting on a truck. He has the added complication of the fact that he's been diagnosed as suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, which is not something you would typically see in a civilian setting, but which has happened a lot to these contractors who are exposed to all sorts of violence on the battlefield. You mentioned you heard him talking about the bulletproof vests. That's because those guys were getting shot at all the time. So it's very understandable why they might come down with a psychological disorder such as PTSD. What happens from the insurance company's point of view is this is not a typical civilian injury, so they're not really set up to deal with it. And what you'll hear from the industry is that how are we supposed to be able to tell whether or not PTSD, this guy actually has it, or is he faking it? There's not a test, not a blood test you can take.
But there's a history, so doctors should be able to find out.
Right, and that's the argument that Bill is going to have to make now. Bill is now has no disability, checks coming to him. He can't work. He's in danger of losing his house. And so he now has to go to a court within the Department of Labor, which administers the system, and he's going to have to prove that he actually has PTSD. And it's a very confrontational system, very slow. It takes minimum of a year or 6 months at least to try and get some kind of a ruling in this. And even then it can be appealed. In these cases, I've seen 4 and 5 years dragging on later without any sort of final adjudication in the guy's case. So Bill's case is sadly kind of typical of what you've seen over there.
Yeah. On the point of foreclosure, our producers actually asked Bill about his financial problems.
I've had to sell things from my house to get any money just to put gas in my car or to pay a reduced amount on my utilities or to pay a reduced amount on my cell phone. And I haven't been able at all to pay anything on my mortgage for the past 7 months. I'm behind. And they're foreclosing on it, and I will literally and utterly be homeless.
T, Bill says AIG owes him medical compensation. What does AIG have to do with the situation, and what has been their response so far?
AIG is the insurance company for Bill's employer, which was the defense contractor, KBR. So under the terms of the contract, AIG has to cover any kind of injuries that Bill suffered over in Iraq. So in this particular case, AIG's responsibility is to pay for any kind of medical care from any injuries he suffered over there, and that would include, in this case, psychological counseling for PTSD and treatment surgeries for his hernias. But it would also include, if he's unable to work, they have to pay some portion of his salary because he can't work anymore because he was injured on the job. And that's what the dispute is about right now, is that AIG has stopped paying him any kind of those disability benefits.
Okay. Now, I want to go to the latest story you wrote in this series about Wade Dill. Can you tell us what's happening with his family now?
Yes. Wade Dill was a pest control guy who went over, again, to work for KBR in Iraq. He came back, and about 3 weeks after he returned, he committed suicide. And he had told his wife that he had been in mortar attacks and there had been sort of all sorts of violence surrounding him. And she blames that experience on the psychological stress of that job in terms of his suicide. Now, she has made a claim as a widow for death benefits in his case, which is something else you can get under this insurance policy. And so far, the insurance company has said no. And in this particular case, their grounds are rooted in the law itself, which was passed back in 1941 when suicide was still not seen as a psychological condition, but more something that you did if you were crazy
people.
Right? And so the law specifically forbids the payment of death benefits in the case of suicide. Now, the military, again, to make the comparison, and I don't want to make a comparison between apples and apples here because civilians are different than soldiers. They could quit any time. They made a lot of money. But in this particular case, the military has continually adapted its policies. And today, the widow of a soldier who commits suicide at least has the opportunity or the ability to make the argument that she should be able to collect the benefits of her husband's salary and some of the other benefits that accrue to a military family. There doesn't seem to be a lot of daylight for the civilian contractors because the law is pretty black and white that if you commit suicide, you're not eligible.
Okay. I want to revisit one of the stories you did before about the Defense Department looking at the entire program. Is there a better way to fund it so that the insurance companies aren't the middlemen or don't get involved?
Right. After we wrote our stories last spring and summer, the Pentagon released a report in which they talked about one way to save money on this program in terms of how much taxpayers pay for it is for the government to kind of take over the payments rather than paying an insurance company like AIG or one of the other ones, such as CNA. The government could kind of self-insure, which is what it does in every other. The federal government has plenty of money to be able to cover injuries to its own workers and employees. And so it does this in every other area of the government. So the suggestion was that the government could take over the system and save, I believe the figure was as much as $400 million a year.
You would think that Congress would be eager to do that right now.
Right. And it just seems like it's a no-brainer to take $400 million, which in the Pentagon's world is not that
small
much
potatoes.
Money. Small potatoes. But nonetheless, it's an easy get. And I've been surprised there hasn't been more action taken on that particular part of this issue.
So beyond the budgetary issues, Congress, has anyone in Congress actually taken this up? Are they championing fixing the problems here?
Yes. That's been one of the more gratifying things is that there are a couple of possibilities on the table to fix this system. There's an easy fix.
What's
which
that?
Is kind of tinkering around with the current law and increasing the penalties if, for instance, an insurance company does something wrong so you can penalize them and hopefully encourage their behavior or encourage proper behavior. And then there's a bigger, much more grandiose fix, which would be to kind of rewrite the whole law and say the government's going to take this over and they'll begin paying for this program. Now, in between those two options, there's a lot of daylight. And when I say there's an easy fix and a hard fix, neither one is simple and would be opposed by the insurance industry, quite obviously. The other issue facing all of Congress these days is that there's just no oxygen left in the room in between healthcare, Iraq, Afghanistan, the economic meltdown. There's not a lot of small to mid-size bills that are going through the House and Senate these days. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of airports on the runway. I mean, there's a lot of airplanes on the runway at O'Hare. So I am hopeful that sometime in this coming up spring session, you'll see some legislative action on this. But you just can't tell.
And I want to know, why is this a ProPublica story?
I think it's a ProPublica story because it's all about accountability. American taxpayers have so far contributed probably $2 billion to paying for this insurance. And so Americans have invested in this, and it's sort of a commitment of our government to this. And we need to be able to say or to hold the insurance companies responsible for delivering the benefits that we've paid for.
Well, T, congratulations on your Seldon Award. This is some really great work.
Thanks so much.
All right. You've been listening to the ProPublica podcast. I am Mike Webb. You can find out more information about our Disposable Army Civilian Contractor series at ProPublica.org/contractors. Thanks to Sharona Coots and Joaquin Sapien for producing this pod. We'll see you next week.